Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 94. We're in September 2017, and we're talking about the crisis in Venezuela, as well as its causes and context. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. My name is Patrick Beja, and this is a show where we cover world news, not tech news. That's my other passion. But we cover world news, and we try to get people from different countries and different cultures and different backgrounds to get together and talk about what's been happening in the world, and mostly tell us how their part of the world saw it and reported on it and thinks on it, on the big stories. So that's what we usually do on the regular shows. And then we often have specials where we focus on one specific country or thing that's happening or story or, you know, one specific item of discussion that we try to cover a little bit more in depth. And this is one such episode. Today, we're going to be talking about Venezuela and what's been happening in the country over the past year. I think we're probably going to have to talk a little bit about what's been happening for the past few years if we want to have a clear picture. And to help us see a little bit more clearly, well, not to help us, but to tell us what's been happening there, I'm very glad and happy to welcome Saul Gonzalez, who was recently, well, who lived in Venezuela until recently. How are you doing, Saul?
Hello, Patrick. Thank you very much for the invitation.
I'm really glad that you're here. Just to explain a little bit, you were in Venezuela until about a month ago, and then you left, and you're currently in Colombia. And you are, if you have if we're getting average to bad sound quality, I apologize in advance. We're sort of put all of this together. Kind of, it was a little bit difficult to put together, but I'm really glad that you can be here and tell us about what's been happening on the ground there, because I think a lot of people, myself included, don't really understand, and we've only heard like Venezuela is a mess, and that's it. So before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself for the audience?
Yes, of course. I am Venezuelan. I was born and raised in Venezuela until 2006. I'm a computer engineer originally. And then in 2006, I got a scholarship to study in Japan to go study game design. So I lived in Japan from 2006 to 2012. And then I went back to Venezuela, been working there until only last month when I was finally able to leave Venezuela, as most people are trying to do because the crisis there is really bad.
So we'll get into the context and the origins of the crisis, but just so people understand your situation, when you say you left Venezuela, you're not like on holidays. Like, what led you to leaving, and how did that work?
Okay, well, the situation in Venezuela is pretty bad right now. I mean, you could say it's the biggest humanitarian crisis in the Americas at this moment, but it's been getting bad and worse over the past decade, at least. So most people, especially young people who had a college or high school education, they've been looking to emigrate. So what we're having now on top of everything is also a kind of migration crisis where most young educated people are leaving the country because it doesn't really afford them any opportunities. So all my friends from college live in, you know, all over the world now because no one wants to stay in Venezuela. So yes, I'm not in holiday. I moved out, and for me the priority was get out of Venezuela somewhere and then settle in the specific country, it was a secondary concern. And that's the case for most Venezuelans.
So just leave, just get out. I'm sort of hearing a kind of hint of get out while you can in your voice. Is that the case, or am I reading something into it?
Well, it depends. It's certainly getting worse as time passes. So certainly, you know, you could reason that the longer you take, the more dangerous it is for you, and the harder it is to get out. So yes, for me, it has a sense of getting out while I still can, because it's going to get worse.
So I have a few friends who were originally, well, not a few, but at least one who is originally Venezuelan. He's been living in Paris for a while, and he was trying to get his parents to leave for months and months, and it was really difficult. Again, just to make it clear for the people listening, are you leaving because the economy is tanking and you can't buy food, or are you leaving because it's dangerous physically and there are, there's a revolution-like atmosphere? Or what? Why exactly are people leaving in so big numbers?
I mean, it's all together. I mean, in the past few years, people will leave because the economy is tanking and they will not see opportunities to find a good job. But more recently, it's more basic than that. The country is really dangerous right now. It's the most dangerous city in the Americas, if not the world. I mean, you get 25,000 people killed every year just by regular crime. So personal safety is a big concern. And this has been for years now. And more recently, it's getting even worse, with the lack of food and lack of medicine. So yeah, it's just getting hard to, you know, just eat enough and have a healthy life. And if you get sick with something that's a little bit hard to treat, or that medicines are not available in Venezuela, as is the case with most medicines, your life could really be at risk. And for me in particular, I also, my job depends a lot on the internet. And telecommunications in general are breaking down in Venezuela because not enough maintenance is done. So it's a case where, you know, life is hard, it's getting harder. And if you look a little bit in the future, it's going to get worse, eventually non-sustainable. So yes, there is a sense of you know, getting, you just need to get out if you want to, you know, keep living.
So it sounds like from what you're saying, we'll get to the context and the cause of all of this in a minute, but it sounds from what you're saying that the source of all of it is economic. It's an economic crisis that is leading to all of these issues. That's why I'm gleaning from what you're saying. And the causes are mostly that the economy is not working. So first of all, is that the case? And second of all, I'm really curious to hear from you directly, how difficult was it to get out of the country, and why was it so difficult? So three questions, I guess. Is it actually an economic crisis only? And then how hard was it to leave?
Okay, well, it is a big economic crisis. And for most people, the direct consequences on people's living are due to the economic crisis. But really, the economic crisis has its own cause on the political crisis, which is that in Venezuela, we don't really have an accountable government anymore. We have a dictatorship that does whatever they want. And basically, they're mismanaging the economy in horrible ways. And I don't think mismanaging is the correct word. Basically, there's really no economy in Venezuela. The economy was completely destroyed. What we have is a flow of oil, I mean, of oil money coming in, which is completely handled by the regime in whatever way they see fit. Mostly it all goes to their own pockets, or it goes to fund the means for them to stay in power. So there's only scraps left for everyone else. So yes, we have a huge economic crisis, but it's not a crisis that is particularly hard to solve. You know, with just an accountable, democratic, decent government in place, we will not have an economic crisis.
Okay, so we'll get to the root causes of all of this and how bad it's been getting, as I said in a little bit. But more immediate concern for you, thankfully in the rearview mirror, but for a lot of people still living in Venezuela,
yes.
How hard was it to get out? Like, that's something that I think might give the measure of how bad the situation is for other people. How did you do it, and how hard was it?
Okay, well, it's been getting harder and harder. Most airlines are leaving the country, basically because, again, we have been in a crisis for the past 5 years. It's just been getting slowly worse. And basically because the country cannot guarantee the minimum conditions for the functioning of an international airport, more and more international airlines are just leaving the country. Just the past 2 months or 3 months alone, half the international airlines just closed operations. I mean, we're talking about, well, Avianca, which is a Colombian airline, left the country, suspended operations to Venezuela, and so many others. So it's been getting harder and harder to get a plane to get out. I mean, especially in my case, it was hard in the sense that we were going to buy a plane ticket and we would quote a price. And then the next day when we were going to actually buy it, since the previous day, three airlines have left the country. Now the ticket price had already doubled from one day to another. And I didn't actually have the money, so I had to take a couple more weeks to save or get enough money to live, and that's the case with airlines, just getting less and less seats available. So for most people, living through land is becoming the only option, and that's also getting harder to do because actually the government closed the frontier closed the border with Colombia, so there's no free access. You had to get special permits to get there. So it's not as hard to live as it is in Cuba, where you basically the government does not allow you people to live, but it's getting just harder and harder, and also for economic reasons. As the economy gets worse and worse, it's harder for people to even afford a plane or even a bus ticket to the border.
So that's what I was going to ask. The government, you're saying they recently closed the borders. Did you have to get a special permit to leave the country?
Okay, the border that's closed is just the physical border with Colombia. I mean,
you can leave. They have they closed the border. You can't go. But does that mean if you had walked or taken a bus, does that mean you couldn't have crossed?
That's the case. I mean, as with many things in Venezuela, it's complicated and there are some written rules and unwritten rules. But basically the point is that depending of where in the border you want to cross, it may be harder or easier. You may have to get a specific permit or not, or you may actually have to, you know, bribe someone to be able to pass. But it really depends.
So I don't understand. Has the government forbidden people to get out of the country? Have they actually closed the border or not? Because it seemed like you're saying, well, we don't know. It's kind of like playing the lottery.
Okay. The government has not forbidden people to leave. If you can get a ticket on a plane, you can leave without no restriction from the government. Okay. What the government disclosed was the land border with Colombia because, well, they claim that is because there were, you know, a lot of people trading goods between Colombia and Venezuela. And this is, you know, because our currency differences are too big, this causes problems for the government. So they didn't want that to happen. So they closed the border. They did close that border.
So specifically the one with Colombia to avoid some kind of trading issues. But it's not like they're telling people, you can't leave the country in any way. Like if you take the plane or if you go, you know, if you want to go somewhere else, it's possible.
No, that's not the case. It's just a thing of closing the land border with Colombia at some specific places.
Okay. All right. Okay, so how did you just got a plane ticket, but was it difficult to immigrate into Colombia? Did you have to get a special visa, or is your situation secure in Colombia? I'm guessing this is a problem as well, because people can't just go anywhere they want without the proper paperwork.
Yes, that's exactly an issue, and actually we have been seeing a phenomenon where most embassies in Venezuela are filled with people who are trying to get nationalized. I mean, for example, if you have an Italian or a Portuguese grandfather, which lots of people in Venezuela do, then people are trying to get, you know, Italian nationality or Portuguese nationality, so it's easier for them to immigrate to a different country. And basically, it really depends on the circumstances of each country. For example, for Colombia, is a particularly hard country to immigrate to. They don't have much immigration-friendly policies. I'm going to be able to stay here because my wife has a Colombian mother, so she can get the nationality. But okay, That's not the case for most Venezuelans. But on the other hand, we're really thankful because the Colombian government developed a special policy to let Venezuelans stay. So they're not calling Venezuelans refugees just yet, but they're saying, we know there's a special situation in Venezuela. We know that a lot of people are trying to flee Venezuela. So they're extending to Venezuelans that meet certain broad conditions a permit to stay for 2 years. So that's really helpful.
So basically, Colombia is welcoming Venezuelan, is essentially what's happening.
Yeah, that's essentially what's happening, and we are very thankful. There have been other efforts. For example, in the border that was closed, there have been a lot of, you know, Venezuelan people just fleeing the country, just leaving as refugees, and people have been setting up food stalls. And people for a place to eat free of charge for Venezuelans, because the situation is so dire. And there are even people who cannot leave, but they cross the border to Colombia, grab some food, and then go back to Venezuela. So Colombia has been really helpful in that regard. On the opposite side, we have countries like Panama, which I'm sad to say actually increased the requirements for Venezuelans. Previously, Venezuelans could go to Panama free of visa, and now they're requiring a visa for Venezuelans. So, of course, that makes things harder for people who are trying to leave the country. So, you know, you have both sides of the equation.
I just want to get a clearer picture of how bad the situation is. So I often say in this show, I'm really dumb, and it's helpful because it helps people see things more clearly when I ask really dumb questions. So here's one of those really dumb questions. You're describing a situation that does sound really dire. On a scale of, you know, perfectly functioning society to post-apocalyptic breakdown zombie invasion, how far along is Venezuela currently? Is there rioting in the street? Is there looting of stores? Are people, you're saying they almost can't eat properly? Are we to the point where there's a concern that you can't get enough food and you need, I don't know, I don't even know how it would work, but that people can't eat enough, there's not enough food in stores? How bad is it in the very practical sense?
Okay, I think we're maybe halfway there to this apocalypse, and depending on the part of the country, I think what you described as an apocalypse is an accurate situation. I mean, it's very heterogeneous. It depends on which part of the country and which part of the city are you talking about. But there are places
where there is looting and rioting.
Yes, there are places where there is looting and rioting. There have been multiple waves of rioting in different cities of the country. Yes, stores just get looted and people, you know, yes, stealing supermarkets, stealing stuff from factories. It's just really out of control. There's really no rule of law in that sense.
Okay. All right. So this is definitely a crisis. I think you've been very clear on that. But I think a lot of people, as I was mentioning earlier, are thinking, yeah, I've heard there's stuff happening, but maybe they didn't realize that people are actually fleeing the country in fear of violence, physical violence, and in fear of economical dire situation, I guess. And the reason, I think, is that, yes, it accelerated in 2017, but this has been, as you mentioned, a crisis that has been 10 years in the making.
Yes.
So let's finally get to that point, which I've been teasing since the beginning of the episode, of why is the situation like this? Why are you now, you know, I guess the Chavists are saying everything's fine and cool, and the others are saying this is a dictatorship. And I, all right, let's get into it. So what led to this whole thing, and how did it happen?
Okay, well, this really happened when Chavez came to power in 1999. But to give a little bit of background before that, in the 60s and 70s were a great time for Venezuela. We had a 10-year dictatorship from 48 to 58. So in the 60s, we were back to democracy, and we also, the oil industry was nationalized and really came into its own. So there was lots of money coming into what used to be an, you know, a kind of poor agricultural country. So Venezuela really modernized pretty fast, and there were lots of opportunities for everyone. But thanks to a mix of, you know, well-intentioned but a little bit naive politicians, and well, you know, playing all corrupt politicians, there was a lot of money being spent, and some of it was well spent, but none of it was spent in a way that led to, you know, long-term sustainability. So back in the 80s, we had our first crisis, which is that, you know, we had economic growth in the 60s and 70s, and in the 80s there was you know, things starting going down. You know, the economy started shrinking again. A lot of people starting, you know, to fall into poverty. So there was the beginning of this, you know, discontent, social discontent within the people from the 80s, and the boiling point was in 89 and in 92. In 89, we had our first, you know, episode of general rioting and looting in Venezuela in 89. And mm-hmm. then in 92, we had two attempts of a coup d'etat led by Chavez. Because Chavez, his background is a military background. So in 92, he attempted to do a coup d'etat that was quickly contained. The coup d'etat failed, but also due to some, you know, really irresponsible politicians that were opposed to the current government, they tried to picture this coup d'etat not as an attack on democracy, which is what it was, but as a, I quote unquote, legitimate attempt by the people that want to complain against the hardships of the current government. So by kind of legitimating this coup d'etat, Chavez became this sort of a folk hero who was, you know, fighting for the people. And this enabled him to first get out of jail. He got a pardon by this very same, you know, irresponsible politician that you know, legitimate him in the first place. And then he was able to run for election. And he was very popular because of his folk hero status. So he was able to become president in 1999.
How bad was the... Before we get to a little bit further, how bad was the situation when he tried his coup d'etat for him to be regarded as a folk hero by anyone? I mean, when you have a military leader that tries to take over the government, the situation must be really bad in order for people to think, yeah, that guy seems pretty cool. So was the situation already very difficult economically?
I mean, at the time, we will have said that it was really difficult, but it was nothing compared to now. I mean, right. I think most people now say we wish we could go back to, you know, to the 90s.
So how
I mean,
Can you give us examples of how, quote-unquote, bad it was, just so we have a point of reference? Like, what were the difficulties? Was it high unemployment? Like, what was the landscape?
Okay, I mean, it was bad. I will say that around 70% of the Venezuelan population live in conditions of poverty. And in Venezuela, this kind of poverty means you live in a slum or a favela. So you have really precarious housing, and basically it's hard to make ends meet. But for the most part, people were at least able to eat. You know, we didn't have widespread malnutrition or hunger like we had now. So you know, a lot of people were in poverty. A lot of people saw that they had few opportunities to leave poverty, to get out of that condition. But on the other hand, people were mostly able to eat and mostly able mostly healthy. And also the crime situation, especially in the slums, was bad, but not nearly as bad as it is now. So, of course, not an ideal situation, a pretty bad situation, but it's worse now.
It seems like the kind of, you know, you're saying 70% of the population was living in poverty and a good portion of those in favelas and slums. You know, when I think of this, sure, I'm sure it's worse now. But when I think of this, I can understand that people would get... I mean, yes, it looks like a bad idea to get Chavez in power from here. But from at that point, I can understand that people would have thought, yeah, let's get someone that's really going to kick everyone in the ass and change things, right?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. I mean, right now, it's easy to say it was misguided. And I think
because the situation is worse. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you know, we will ask, you know, better accountability for politicians. And you know, this is a complex story because if you get down into you know, the details of it, and there was actually a movie about this in Venezuela just last year. But the government at the time, which the president was named Carlos Andrés Pérez, and he was the president from 88 to 93, he was actually starting to put some better policies in place. But building sustainable growth, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. So one way to read this story is that, you know, he was actually doing the right thing. He could have been more politically savvy about the way he did things. But in the end, his political opponents used the general discontent to, you know, drive him out of power, promote this coup d'etat against him for their own political gain. In a way, you could say, okay, yes, there was discontent, there was reasons to be discontented, but in the end, you know, this anger got fooled, you know, into the wrong place, you know, led us to an even worse place instead of, I mean, it was legitimate, but it led us down a very bad road.
Okay, so we'll get back to 99 in a second. There's one thing which intrigued me in what you're saying, which is the infrastructure was really bad in the 90s, and you know, people were living in bad conditions, and it got worse since. But you're saying you're a computer engineer, so I'm curious. Does it mean you work mostly with mobile technology because that's what the country is equipped with? Or did the internet infrastructure of the country get built up because it's necessary for modern living? Or how does it work being a computer engineer in that kind of low infrastructure country?
Okay, well, sadly, the story of Venezuela is one of inequality. So, like I say, in the 70s or even in the 80s, parts of the city were very, very well developed. So basically, you know, most cities in Venezuela are split into two. A part where you have a normal, modern city equipped with plenty of modern infrastructure, the internet and such, and you can mostly live as you will live in a developed, you know, developed city elsewhere in Latin America. And then you have the slums. where again is where 70% or 80% of the people live, and they don't have any infrastructure. So part of the cause of this anger was also, you know, a difference of class anger. You know, people who live in the slums say, okay, we are poor, we don't have we don't have good infrastructure, we don't have good housing, and then you have, you know, this 10% or 20% of people who live in normal houses, who live in normal buildings, who have the internet, who have, you know, all the luxuries of modern life. So there was also a part of hate of this anger saying, okay, why do these sorts of people have all these modern commodities and benefits, and why we don't? So in this case, I have to say I am privileged to have been born into a middle class family that was, you know, on this side of the fence, on the side that had, you know, access to, you know, decent schooling, decent education, and decent infrastructure.
Right. So it's about 30 million people in the country. So I guess it's like 5 to 10 million who are living with the comfort of modern living, and 20 to 25 million who are living in poor conditions.
Yes, that's an accurate description from most of the 80s to until 5 years ago.
Okay, so let's keep moving forward. 99, what happened in 99?
Okay, well, Chavez got to power and he was, you know, extremely popular. And he was also very, very lucky to come to power at the same time that there was, you know, a huge increase in oil prices. So he had access to a kind of money that no government in the previous 20 or 30 years had access to. So he was able to
just to clarify, sorry to interrupt. When you say he got to power, he was elected, democratically elected, right?
Yes, he ran and he was democratically elected in 1998, and he took power. He assumed the presidency in 1999. He was democratically elected. Yes.
All right. So yeah, he came into power. The oil prices were incredibly high. Keep going.
Okay. So he basically started to. He said that, you know, everything that came before him was terrible and had to be changed. So basically he started to remake the government and the whole country, you know, on his own image, or, you know, however he pleased. And he was able to do this because he was able to spend a lot of money, which gave him a lot of popularity. He had many social programs, which were in many ways good to the people. He went to the slums and started providing a little bit better infrastructure. He also had a lot of what he called missions, which were, you know, programs to give poor people access to food, access to health, again, ways to improve the infrastructure. They gave him credits for them to start their own enterprises. So that's all well, but there was also the flip side to this, which is that the government also became increasingly authoritarian. He started to do away with all the checks and balances that the democratic government has. And because he was popular with poor people, which was most of the people, no one really cared that much.
Could you give us examples of how he would do away with checks and balances?
Yes. For example, a very famous example was when he fired all the judges in all the courts and replaced them with judges that were friendly to him, friendly to the quote-unquote revolution.
Just to be clear, he fired all of the judges in the entire country. I'm guessing not every single one, but the bigger ones. And replaced them with people whom he liked.
Exactly.
And how did that go over? When was that? And did no one say that's not cool?
Okay, well, actually, a better example will be in 2001, which is that, you know, as I've been telling you, I mean, as I've been implied, but maybe not outright said, Venezuelan economy is really, really dependent on oil. You know, more than 90% of our income comes from oil. So basically, oil is the way, you know, the government runs and basically the way the whole economy has been built, which is not good, but it's the case. So Basically, there's this company that handles the oil industry, which is called PDVSA. And this company is, of course, managed by the government and owned by the government. But until 2001, 2002, they had some level of independence, just like, you know, the central bank has its level of independence. So most of the company was run by the same people that had run it, you know, very successfully over the last 20 and 30 years. But in 2001, Chavez says, okay, I'm going to replace all the managers of PDVSA, and I'm going to remake PDVSA and make it, you know, be, work more for the people. Because basically what happened in 2001 and 2002 is that, you know, both PDVSA and the central bank are really important to the economy. They have a mission, which is to, you know, to guarantee efficient, non-corrupt us of all the oil income and the stability of the currency. And there are several laws in place that govern, you know, what the president, the executive power can do or not do regarding those. And again, in 2001, Chavez said, okay, I'm going to do away with all of that. I'm going to appoint people I want to the head of PDVSA and the central bank, and I'm going to manage both of those however I want. And of course, there was a lot of opposition to that. And there was nationwide marches and protests against Chavez because of this. And this resulted in 2002 in a brief after of power for Chavez in 2002. I mean, he was removed from power for 3 days, because basically what happened is there was this huge mass of people who were, you know, against Chavez, who said, you know, Chavez, you are doing good things, but you cannot, you know, do away with you know, with these institutions. We had checks and balances, precisely. And there was this huge march, and the march was advancing towards the presidential palace. And it's not entirely clear what the truth is of what happened, but the point is that someone somewhere started shooting at the people who were marching at exactly the same moment that Chavez was doing a national broadcast. And a lot of people think that basically Chavez ordered some snipers to shoot at people to, you know, disperse this march. So what this has as a result is that some people in the military decided that Chavez had overstepped the line. So they moved against the presidential palace and took over and had Chavez leave power. He was ousted for a few days. But what happened is that he was moved to an island off the coast in Venezuela. But over the next 2 or 3 days, other group of military people who were pro-Chavez battled the other ones, and they were able to prevail. So they reinstated Chavez in power. So basically, what happened
point is that at that point, it was basically civil war. It wasn't very long, but it was civil war.
Yes, in the end, happily, this did not result in a lot of bloodshed. There was not much of, there was again this case of snipers firing into you know, civilians who were peacefully marching. But other than that, the struggle between these military factions, to many people's surprise, was not very overt. There was not, you know, not a lot of shooting and bombing or firing of artillery. It was more of a thing of you know, measuring forces and a lot of things that happened, you know. Not all the facts are known, because there are, of course, many lies thrown around. I think we will only know the full history as time goes on. But the point is that there was a crisis. Chavez was removed from power, then reinstated. So in a sense, there was a crisis, and Chavez managed to come out of the crisis more powerful than before. Because this also gave him an opportunity to do away with, you know, all the people in the military that had opposed him so far. So the general sense is that, you know, Chavez was able to, after this, Chavez was able to do whatever he wanted. So, you know, he just after this crisis, he said, okay, you know, we had a coup d'état. I mean, I was removed from power. I'm a democratically elected leader, which he was at the time. So I'm now taking emergency measures. And basically, this crisis enabled him to do the thing that he wanted to do in the first place. That was, you know, remove this first set of checks and balances.
So do you think this is incredibly, subjective, but
yes.
Do you think he was initially at least well-intentioned? Do you think that all of those things that seem, to be honest, when we look from anywhere, seeing, the replacement of judges and the authorities managing the money of the country with people who are relatively, who are friendly to him, would not look very democratic. But I'm sure that in some people's minds, it's because those judges and people managing the money were favoring the 5 or 10, the 10 or 20% of the middle and upper class of the country, and not caring about the millions living in the favelas. But do you think he was at least well intentioned, or was he always looking at himself as a general getting the power in the country and basically establishing slowly a dictatorship? And again, I understand this is subjective, but what do you think?
Okay, yes, of course, this is all very subjective. I don't claim to, to be the owner of the whole truth. And of course, every change that he made, every replacement of people, every check and balance that he destroyed, he and his supporters always claimed that it was necessary for the revolution, and that whatever he was destroying because it was bad, and he was, favoring the oligarch. He loved to use this word. Everyone who was not poor, or everyone who was not a supporter of him, is an oligarch. So Steve was always, what he and his supporters will claim. If you let me to give my own personal take on this, I think he was well intentioned in the beginning. Of course, a lot of people say someone who attempts to take power by force, as he tried to do in 1992, can never be called well intentioned. And some people from that moment, from the moment that Chavez was running as a candidate, were already, predicting everything bad that came later. But personally, I think he was well intentioned. And there was also someone who was a huge influence in him was Fidel Castro. He really always looked up to the Castros and looked up to Cuba. For me personally, I was, on defense of whether Chavez was good or bad in the first few years. At the moment, I was a teenager or a young adult. I was 18 or 19 at the time, so I was not as mature as I am now. But I was on the fence of whether Chavez was good or bad. Maybe a little bit leaning into hopeful, in the sense that his government was very different from those that came before. But in around 2001, when he started talking about eroding these checks and balances, and especially when he started talking about how great Cuba is and how great a leader Castro is what, that really changed the situation for me. That's when I myself started thinking of myself as something who is strongly anti-Chavez. Mm. But as rumor has it, Fidel Castro was a very strong influence in him, and he started advising him to build his government as a revolution, and especially to make keeping and holding into power at all costs his main priority. So for him, he started switching from being, a democratic leader who wants to help people into an authoritarian leader whose priority is first, stay in power, and second, help people. So there's many stories about the first few years in the government, and in he had many supporters, and many of them were capable people, but many of them started leaving the government because they realized, this guy Chavez is doesn't really care about doing things the right way. He cares just about keeping power. There are many stories about his people at many levels in the government who started to denounce instance of corruption, and when Chavez did nothing, they left. And there's this rumor that Chavez actually favors corruption, because when someone in the government becomes corrupt, they become complicit in whatever Chavez is doing, so they cannot leave as easily. Basically, a mayor that has been corrupt and Chavez knows, then Chavez could use that to hold it over him and say, if you ever cross me, I will use this against you. So he was really building this whole apparatus of you know, loyalty to him, loyalty to the revolution and to the regime first, and then, you know, doing good things for people second.
All right. You know, I was sighing as you were talking about all of this, because it feels like it's so, you know, it's the story that we've seen 1,000 times. Yes. And every time it's the same. And the only way of not falling into those traps is to be very scrupulous about the democratic process. And that's why it's in place. So, all right. So that was early 2000s. Let's move forward to, you know, when was it that he passed away? Was it? I'm being very, very 2009. Oh, 12. Okay. So when was died?
Actually, yes. To be completely clear on this, the official figures are questionable. I mean, he got sick in 2012. He went to Cuba. He had cancer. I'm not sure exactly where the cancer is. He went to Cuba to get better. To get medical treatment in Cuba at late 2012, and in December 2012, it started to be widely reported that he had died. And after that point, no one ever saw him again. I mean, there had been like some pictures of questionable veracity of whether he was alive or not. But the general consensus, I mean, most Venezuelans, is that he died in December 2012. But the government did not actually announce that he had died and hold elections until March 2013. So there's this, you know,
okay,
questionable facts around his death there.
Okay, so around 2012, 2013, what was the situation like, and what happened in the election?
Okay, well, that's an historic story. The way of ruling that Chavez has in the first 10 years was not really sustainable. It depended on, you know, having a lot of oil money and spending that oil money to gain popularity, and also racking up massive national debt.
Sorry to interrupt again, but you're saying using oil money to gain popularity. What did he do to gain that popularity? How did he distribute that money?
Okay, well, as I say, he had a lot of social programs. He did actually improve the infrastructure in the slums a little bit. And what I mean is, the idea will be, you know, to replace the slums for affordable housing, you know, sustainable buildings and sustainable housing developments. What he did instead was go to the slums and provide them with gas, provide them with electricity, provide them with better roads. So people who were living in poverty really did see their conditions improve, and there was a lot of money going around. So people were able to get a little bit better salaries, a little bit better food. Also, there was lots of credits, just money being given to poor people to try and start, you know, their own enterprises, their own businesses, or just to, you know, again, to improve their living infrastructure. The problem with this is that it's hard to say whether it was well-intentioned or badly or not as well-intentioned, because most of this was not really sustainable. I mean, a lot of people was going to spend to people in poverty, but they were not really able to leave poverty. Especially, there were almost no investments done in education, and also the investments were not done in a responsible manner. For example, let's say there's a group of poor people that ask for a credit or ask for money to repair something in their community, and the government will just give them the money, but there was no accountability. In many of these cases, people just pocket the money or use it in an irresponsible way. So again, there was money spent in lots of ways that made poor people happy, but that in the long term did not really help them. And the evidence of that is that now, you know, most of those gains are you know, were destroyed. You know, people are as bad now as they were before Chavez, because all the investment he did in social programs was not sustainable development. It was, right, giving people money to keep them happy. And also, I say game popularity because this also, all this money had very strong strings attached. I mean, Chavez will give people money by the same. You get this if you keep voting for me. Vote for me and I will give you this. Support me and I will give you this. But cross me and I will take it all away. And this was not antitrust. This actually happened.
Did he actually say this? Did he literally say, if you don't vote for me, I will take away the money?
Yes, I'm not 100% sure, but I think he said pretty close to this. And there's also facts. I mean, there was this in 2004, there was this signature drive to hold a referendum to call for a new presidential election. I mean, basically a referendum to oust Chavez from power. And the opposition had to collect signatures. And the government got a hold of this list of signatures. And this became a very famous list, because if you were on the list, you will not get access to any kind of government support or any kind of government services. So if you actually signed against Chavez, if you were on record as opposing Chavez, then he will cut you off and he will, you know, make your life hard in any way he could. So there was also a lot of retaliation.
All right, so let's get back to 2012, 2013. What was the country like and what happened in the election?
Okay, well, what actually happened is that the oil prices started to go down. So the economy started to slow down and we started to see, you know, the consequences of this unsustainable way of ruling. But in a way, Chavez was very lucky because he at the right moment not to see the consequences of his wrongdoing. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, he ruled in
you
this
said,
unsustainable
you cut
way.
Off, you cut off a little bit. You said he died at the right moment to not to see the consequences, right?
Yes. Like he was saying, he was government in an unsustainable manner. And when the chickens were coming home to roost and the consequences of this unsustainable development were starting to become a reality, he died. So he never got on any of the blame of it. So in 2013, we had an election, and Chavez had a hand-picked successor, which is Maduro, who is the president now. He before leaving for Cuba, he said in the national chain that he asked the people that in the event that anything happened to him, they should vote for Maduro.
Just to be clear, yes. He respected the constitution on the number of terms. I guess he died, so he couldn't have done any otherwise. But he respected the constitution. He didn't change the constitution to stay in power for longer than he should have, or anything like that.
Yes. Mostly yes. He mostly respected the constitution. He tried to change the constitution several times, but every time he tried to hold a referendum to change the constitution. And in 2000, I don't remember if it was 2011 or 2012, but at some point, I mean, he held a referendum to change the constitution in 2007, six or seven, and he lost. So he was not able to change the constitution at the time. He did change it after all by bits and pieces over the years. But I think 2011 or 12, he held another referendum to change the constitution, and this time he won. And what he did was change term limits and to make him able to be, you know, reelected indefinitely.
Oh, okay, but so he did change the constitution. Okay.
He did All change right. the constitution, but he was not really able to take advantage of that change because he died.
But successors might be.
Yes, successors may be able to do that.
Is there suspicion over the way the referendum was held, or is it clear that it was held democratically and that was actually a successful referendum?
I think most people say that up until 2012, most of the votes were correct. I mean, there's especially one aspect that was not democratic was abuse of public funds. I mean, he will very clearly, very plainly use government money to promote himself, to promote his candidates. So it's not really a fair competition. But other than that, it's mostly understood that the election was, you know, the votes are the actual votes. The numbers are not made up.
All right. So 2013, his designated successor, Maduro, is elected.
Yes, he's elected. And in this case, we first see the first cases in Venezuela of contested elections. Basically, according to the General Elections Board, Maduro narrowly won the election, but the general understanding is that actually he narrowly lost. And basically, there were some shenanigans behind the scenes that allowed him to flip the scale to the other side. Mm. The person who ran against him, Capriles, he's an opposition politician, active even now, and he denounced the results. He claims that they were fake, that he won. But basically, you know, there was not much that anyone could do. We in Venezuela petitioned the international community to do something, but there was not enough interest from the international community. So in the end, what happened is that, of course, a lot of people will give you different versions of the truth. But I think nowadays, most people in Venezuela, we say that Maduro stole the election and got away with it.
All right. So that's 2013, and we're getting close to the situation now. I'm guessing it's a steady progression to the situation we are in today.
Yes.
How did the situation go? Was it just a continuation of what had happened before without the oil money? Or how did the situation evolve? And most importantly, how did we get to and what is happening now in 2017?
Okay, yes. Starting from late 2013, early 2014 is when we see a real deepening of the crisis, which is the oil money running out. And the situation is worse than before. Because at least in the 80s and 90s, we have a productive society. We had factories, we had farms. And something that I failed to mention is that during the years that Chavez was popular and flush with oil money, he used his popularity to take over of all productive activity in the country. I mean, he bought or he, I don't know what the English word for
he
this
nationalized?
Is. He nationalized almost every industry. And I mean, all the farms, all the factories, he nationalized. And what invariably happened is that he will put not capable people in place, but cronies in place. And of course, you know, productivity will go down, will, you know, just flatten, go to the bottom. And then, you know, all the productivity in the country will be destroyed. So just to be clear,
you mentioned it. I mean, I think most people understood. But basically, Chavez was implementing a hardline communist policy, ensemble of policies. He was doing the communist handbook of social change, right?
Yes, he calls it socialism. I mean, he calls it 21st century socialism. But yes, it's basically communism. He was restricted by the constitution, which was still, you know, a democratic, mostly capitalist, you know, respect of free enterprise, respect of private property constitution. So he had some limits on what he could do. It was not a full-on communist regime. But in the practice, yes, he was nationalizing most of the country.
That's an important distinction, there you go, to do, because I know a lot of our American audience will hear socialism, and I often say, you know, and they think communism. That's the origin of, historically, I think socialism is understood as communism. In France, when we say we're a socialist country and Europe is a socialist continent, obviously, it's not the same socialism. I mean, the socialism we have in France might be the farthest to the left of the Western world and of the developed countries, but clearly we have a much more capitalistic, free mm-hmm. enterprise outlook on society, and the The socialist policies are things like, national education programs, healthcare, unemployment benefits, these kinds of things. But the capitalistic free enterprise, free market aspects of it are very much respected and very important. So, that's a point I wanted to make very quickly. But when you're saying Chavez called it 21st century socialism, I think that's in the sense a very common, historically common sense of, yes, communism is what that basically means when we say that kind of socialism.
Yeah, I personally think, I'm sorry for everyone in the world, but I think Chavez basically ruined the word socialism. And it's going to be hard for anyone from this point on to agree on what socialism actually means. I think the word is now too loaded and means too many different things to many different people. So maybe we need to retire the term and change, use different terms to more accurately mean what we mean. Because, yes, it's too loaded now.
So he nationalizes a lot of the infrastructure industry, farming, factories, all of this. They are not being run properly because there is cronies who don't know what they're doing. So yes. That means that productivity and the economy tanks even more. And then there isn't a inflow of oil money to artificially keep things going kind of well.
Exactly.
When Maduro inherits the country, basically, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. As was implied by what you just said, when Chavez basically, destroyed the productive apparatus in the country, it was not as obvious. The consequences were not as obvious because basically he used the inflow of oil money to import. So he substituted, national productions with imports, which is part of the reason that many, many other countries in Latin America at the time loved him, because Venezuela was a great market. He had lots of money and no stuff, so he had to get stuff from everywhere else. So the point that I'm getting at is that when in 2013, when Maduro is in power and the oil money runs out, and part of the reason it runs out is not only because the oil prices come crashing down, but also because the productivity of the national oil company also went down, because again, he replaced everyone with cronies who don't really know what they're doing. So again, there's no money to import now. And before, in the 80s and 90s, even if we had no oil money, we had, ways to produce food and medicine and stuff in Venezuela, but that's all gone now. So that's what brings to the current crisis, which is that in Venezuela, we have nothing, we cannot produce anything, and we have no money to import anything. So that's when you start to see these acute shortages of food and medicine.
Mm. So just so I understand, let's say you don't have enough wheat to make, to make food. Chavez will decide, we'll buy wheat from, I don't know, I'll just say a random name, from Brazil. He uses oil money to buy wheat from Brazil, he puts it in the stores in Caracas. And how does he actually distribute the wheat or, whatever, I'm saying wheat, but maybe it's like meat or produce or whatever. He puts it in the stores and people buy it to feed their families. Is that how it works?
Yes. Basically, there's a little bit of blur because the government became so omnipresent that it's hard to see where the line between the private and the public, is. But basically, so an important piece of the puzzle is that Chavez put currency controls in place as early as 2003. So basically, there was no free exchange of Venezuelan money, which is bolivares, and foreign currency, which you can use to buy things outside of Venezuela. So let's say you are a private entrepreneur and you want to import things, you have to go to the government. And the government will be the one that will actually, take your bolivares, take your Venezuelan money, and give you, foreign money. And for many, many years, the currency was artificially inflated. I mean, there was, free market prices, but what Chavez will do, it will give, cheap dollars or foreign currency at below market rate to importers, so they were able to buy food, to buy stuff to import. So to give you a clearer picture, Chavez will not directly buy things, but his policies are what will enable people to import foreign goods into Venezuela.
And those policies are supported by lots and lots of oil money.
Which, exactly.
Yeah, 2013, that runs out. All right, let's go back on the path from 2013 to 2017. Keep going.
Okay, so what started to happen is that after 2013, we started to see, really even worse than before, mismanagement of the economy, and the prevailing theory is that Chavez, he was a strong leader, and basically he could get people in the government to do whatever they want. But Maduro is not as strong, so there's lots of factions within the government, fighting among themselves, doing whatever they want. So the government and the country becomes even more grossly mismanaged. So we started to see really acute shortages of food and medicine mostly. The economy also goes down with the corresponding increase in crime. So at this point, the government becomes, the Chavez side, Maduro is a continuation of Chavez, but the regime becomes even more unpopular. I mean, up to in 2013, you could say that the country was split in halves, which is why you will say that Maduro either narrowly won or narrowly lost the election. But in 2014, support for the government started really coming down, and the government's response is to become even more autocratic and starting, using these more hardline tools to suppress dissent. And in 2014 is when we start seeing this wave of protests, this wave of marches. But now they're not being allowed to peacefully protest. That's when we start to see the military and the National Guard starting to use, disproportionate force against protesters. This is when we begin to see, mass arrests. And in general, is when we start to see, general disregard and disrespect for the Constitution and for the law.
Can you give us a few examples of this before we move on to 2017?
Okay, well, basically in 2014, we had a wave of protests from February to May. And basically all the opposition politicians that took a part on this were put in jail, in trumped up charges. Mm. I mean, even now, the leader of those protests is in jail, and a lot of politicians are internationally deemed to be political prisoners. So it's really in 2014 that we started to see an increase, a really sharp increase in political prisoners in Venezuela. I mean,
So you would say
in 2003,
that,
yes?
You would say that the regime flipped over to full dictatorship in 2014?
Yeah, I will say that in 2014, it started to take a more authoritarian turn. It was gradual. It was a gradual change from being a democracy for being a dictatorship. And it's really now in 2017 when it's now a full-on 100% dictatorship that is internationally recognized as such. So there was hardly one single moment where you will say it flipped. It was more or less of a gradual change.
Okay. So, all right. So let's get to 2017 then. What's the situation now? How much of a dictatorship is it? You were saying 100%. How would you say that this manifests? And what's the situation with the people who have, from 2013 to now, become more opposed to the government?
Okay. Well, basically, there's now a complete disregard on part of the government of anything that's related to the law. For example, a very common case is that the government, everyone that's protesting on the street or everyone who is part of an opposing political party, the government just puts them into jail. And even if in many cases the courts say release them or at least let them go because they have a you know, a disease released on humanitarian grounds, the jailers of the regime just disregard that and keep people basically kidnapped. I mean, there was a very iconic case just 2 days ago. There was this opposition politician that had been jailed for over a year, and he started to get very sick. He was denied medical attention, and even the courts, you know, said a month ago, just release him, because we don't want him to die in jail. And basically, the people manning the prisons just didn't want to let him go, and he died in jail 2 days ago. And just like that, we have over 300, or I don't know the exact figure, but over 100 political prisoners in Venezuela, including mayors. Right? There has been this worrying trend over the last year where the Maduro regime just decides to remove opposition mayors from office and put them in jail. There's this chilling statistic that I just came across 2 days ago again, that says that over 30% of Venezuelan people, I mean, that's 20 million people, they had their mayors, their democratically elected mayors, removed from office and being governed by deputy mayors, because their legitimate mayors were just imprisoned by the regime, yeah, or otherwise removed from the regime. Other way that you can say this is an open dictatorship is that we had elections for our Congress. Our Congress is called the National Assembly in 2015, and this was a huge win for the opposition, in the sense that most of the deputies elected were opposition deputies. And, you know, they tried to start a democratic process to bring some order and stabilize the country. And what has happened is that the government is just ignoring them de facto. I mean, he just doesn't pay any attention to anything that they do. Their decisions are not being respected. Many of them have been jailed anyway. And what I think cemented the fact that Maduro is not a dictatorship is that 2 or 3 months ago, he called for what we call a constituent assembly. Basically, a constituent assembly is an assembly to remake the constitution. But more importantly, he says that the constituent assembly is a superpower. It means it is superior to all other powers of the state. So whatever the constituent assembly says, it's more important or has priority over whatever the courts say, the Congress says, or even he himself says. So he called for the election of this superpower, but there are two important things here. The first is that the Constitution requires to hold a referendum to ask the people if there should be a constituent assembly in the first place. And he just ignored that and skipped the referendum. And the second one is that we already had about, 2 months ago, the election for the Constituent Assembly, and the numbers were just completely made up. The election was a completely sham election. And it was so obvious that the company that is the supplier for the electronic voting machines, after the election, came up and said that they could not vouch for the validity of the results of the election. So we gone. So in the Chavez era, we had elections. You could say that they were not fair, that there was some abuse. But now we gone all the way to completely sham, completely made up numbers in the elections.
How dangerous is it to express dissent publicly in the country? And I'm even afraid to ask how dangerous is it for you to be speaking on this show right now?
Well, for me, it's not so dangerous because I'm not in Venezuela.
What about right now, your family, or if you ever want to go back, or are you just thinking I'm never going to go back until it's fixed?
Okay, well, I'm thinking I'm never going to go back until it's fixed. And there are many people speaking against the regime. I only one of many, so I don't think they will go as far as to target my family. Really, the government has taken what I will call a surgical approach to repression, which is not mass shootings, not mass jailings, but enough to instill fear in the people. So, for example, there have been, you know, maybe 10 or 20 people who have been jailed by tweeting against the regime, just by tweeting, using Twitter to speak against the regime. And of course, there's thousands, tens of thousands of people who are, you know, tweeting against the regime, but just by hailing, you know, just by putting into jail, a small fraction is enough to instill fear and to say this could happen to me. Again, when we had a massive wave of protests from this year, from again February until I guess June, and what will happen is that the government will go out and kill one or two protesters every day. So he will not, you know, he will not go out with machine guns and kill thousands of people, but he will kill one or two. So again, enough to instill fear in people that, you know, if I go out and protest, I may be killed.
That is, indeed, that does sound like a dictatorship, and it's freaking scary. It's really interesting to see all of the way things degenerated from a bad situation, which I think everyone agrees it's not like things were ideal before, into this horror, which, I mean, everyone's fleeing now, as we discussed in the beginning of the show, and mostly I'm guessing it's middle class to upper class people who can afford to leave the country.
You will say that there are like two immigration movements. So there are like when you say upper class and middle class people who are fleeing in a more orderly manner, which is, you know, go to a country, go to an European country, or go to the US, or go to Argentina, and hopefully with a visa, with a chance to get a job there. And we have been seeing that for years now, for the past 10 years or so now. But now, as the crisis deepens, over the past 2 years, we have seen a second wave of migrants, which may be more accurate to call refugees. And they are just, you know, poor people who are crossing the border on foot and you know, just arriving somewhere with, you know, no food, no luggage, no means to sustain themselves. So basically, it's the two kinds of migration now.
Right. So people are, and again, just to be clear, the people who are fleeing, just walking away, is because there's no food and no work, obviously, but even worse, no food? Or why are they leaving exactly?
Yeah, I would say that the number one reason is because there is no food. The food situation in Venezuela is really bad. I mean, most people I know have lost weight over the past 2 or 3 years. There's really, I mean, I think everyone is suffering more or less. Everyone is eating less than before. Depending on how bad your situation is, you're losing more or less weight. And for the really destitute people, for the really poor people, they're basically rummaging the trash to find food. I mean, if you go to Caracas right now, the first thing that will, you know, grab your attention is that everywhere there's people, you know, just scavenging and rummaging through trash to find something to eat. So it's a really desolate situation.
All right. Well, I think we've more or less covered what we needed to, and I hope people understand a little bit better what's happening in the country. Before we leave, however, I'd like to ask you first, how do you see the situation evolving, although that's going to be a guess, I suppose. And you know, is there anything else you would like to add that I didn't think to ask?
Okay. Yes. Well, I don't mean to be a downer, but the situation is really depressing. There was this famous article by this journalist, an international journalist. Her name is Hannah, but I forget her last name. She was a journalist stationed in Venezuela precisely during the crisis, from 2013 to 2017, when they had to pull her out. I think she was with Associated Press. And she said that just because a situation is bad doesn't mean that it won't get worse, because a lot of people assume that the situation is so bad in Venezuela that it can only get better now. But sadly, that is not the case. And it's really depressing because every day that goes on, not only you have people dying from hunger, but you have children who are being born and not getting enough food, you know, to be able to sustain themselves. And even if they don't die, they develop in not the correct way, so they grow up with defects on their cognitive and physical abilities. So this spells a really bad time for Venezuela in the future, because even if things were to be fixed now, or even in a year or 2 years, we already have a whole generation of people who you know suffer severe malnutrition at birth or close to birth, and that is not going to enable them to grow up to be normal. So the situation has both short-term and long-term consequences. What I would like to people to know and understand is that the situation in Venezuela is really bad. I think it's hard to explain the situation in a way that doesn't sound exaggerated or overly dramatic, but it's really quite bad. And right now, what Venezuela needs the most is international support, because it's quite clear that we are not going to be able to solve this situation by ourselves. I mean, we already tried, you know, removing Maduro through every democratic or using nonviolent resistance means, which is what all the protests in the first half of this year were, and they failed. And they failed because, you know, we have a bunch of thugs, a bunch of criminals with weapons ruling the country, and really no way to unseat them. So it's really the international community that needs to step in and do something. It's hard to say what's the right approach. I'm not a political expert. I'm not an historian to say what's the right way. I don't know if that means sanctions. I don't know if that means, you know, a Noriega-style operation when there's a commando that comes in and kidnaps Maduro. I don't know if that's, you know, the UN sends the blue helmets, the peacekeepers. I don't know if that's a military intervention. But I think either of those, it will be better than the continuation of what's happening right now, which is the situation in Venezuela just getting worse and worse and millions of people suffering. So yes, what I would love to see happen is even more interest from the international community, even more pressure from all the countries in the world against the regime, so we can really see, you know, meaningful change in Venezuela as soon as possible. And when that happens, it doesn't mean that Venezuela will get better overnight. I mean, I think that at best we have, you know, after a change in government, we probably have, you know, a good 10 to 20 years of rebuilding to be done before we get even to where we were before Chavez, which was still not a good situation. But also time is of the essence here. The sooner regime change happens, the sooner we can start to rebuild.
And so the bands of thugs that you were talking about, again, just to be clear, they're profiting from the situation, right? It's similar to any dictatorship or communist regime. They're making money and they're living a good life. I'm guessing all of those, regime and infrastructure that was put in place by the regime, they don't want to give away the power because they're happy with the situation, I'm guessing.
That's part of the reason they don't want to give power. But yes, to be clear, I mean, to give an idea, over the past 15 years, Venezuela received as much money as Dubai and as the United Arab Emirates. And you can see the change that this country has had over the past 15 years. I mean, they have huge buildings, amazing infrastructure now. And we in Venezuela had the same amount of money. And what happened? Well, it went 90% of it went into the pockets of the people who are, you know, now leading the regime. And they don't want to leave for two reasons. One is, just like you mentioned, you know, they have lots of money, they have lots of power, basically they, you know, they can do whatever they want, but also many of them, if not all of them, are guilty of multiple crimes against humanity, crimes against human rights. So they know that if they leave power, they are probably going to jail. I mean, it's not like they're going to be able to go somewhere and enjoy all their ill-gained money. They are probably going to prison if they leave power. So that's also a problem, that many of them don't really have an out, which is why many of them would rather, you know, see the country, you know, burn or and rule over the ashes than giving away power.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're reaching the end of this episode. Thank you so much, Saul, for being on and taking the time to talk about all of this to us. Is there any online presence you want to tell people about if they want to reach out to you or find you on the internet? Anything you want to promote?
Okay. Well, yes. If they want to find me, I am on Twitter. My Twitter is in Spanish, SaulGD. Which in English will be ESAULGD. If you want to ask any questions about Venezuela, I'm always more than happy to answer. And also there's this great resource that reports on what's happening in Venezuela in English. It's called CaracasChronicles.com. Caracas as in, you know, the capital of Venezuela, Caracas, and Chronicles as in the English word Chronicles. So if you want to know, you want to be more informed, you want to get more first-hand accounts of what's happening in Venezuela, that's really a great resource for English speakers. And I'm not related to them in any way. I just like the website.
All right. Cool. I will include the link to your Twitter account and to Caracas Chronicles in the show notes. So if people are interested, hopefully they can go and find them there. Well, you know, it's kind of hard to end the show with such a difficult topic, but I guess I'm going to try. Again, thank you very much, Saul, for being on. For me, if you want to find me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter and on Facebook. You can also find the show at frenchspin.com, and you can also find ways to support, well, the one way to support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thePhileas Club. You have the links in the show notes, and you can do that very easily. You can support the show $1, $2, $3 a month, if you think we're doing an okay job, if you think we're informing you in ways that you won't find it somewhere else, or maybe we're sometimes even entertaining you and making those pieces of news interesting and making you listen to those things, even though you wouldn't if it was just on, I don't know, CNN or the New York Times or Fox News or whatever your preferred method of information is, please consider going to patreon.com/thePhileas Club and giving a little bit of money. It's very easy to do. It takes a couple of minutes and you can stop wherever you want, whenever you want, if you choose to. And a million thanks to the people who decide to actually support the show, because you are the reason it actually happens. So thank you very much. And you're the reason why we can do something like this and get you those special episodes as well, which we probably wouldn't do if we weren't getting the support we are. So again, patreon.com is the way to support us. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back very shortly with another regular episode. And again, to conclude the episode, I really want to thank Saul for being on. You've painted a really interesting picture of the situation and something that I think we couldn't have done without someone like you taking the time to talk about all of this to us too. Thank you very much, Saul.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I see it this way as, you know, my small contribution to what's happening in Venezuela. The more people that know and have an accurate picture of what's happening, the better.
I hope that happened a little bit with this episode. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.